originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I am your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I am joining you tonight from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio. I would like to thank everyone listening on Sirius 219, XM 206, and also to those of you tuning into our website at www.horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. Please, if you're able to help, visit their website at www.pdjf.org. So my guest this evening was the Eclipse Award-winning apprentice in 1979 at the very young age of 17, and that was just the beginning. He went on to find great international success, including 5 French riding titles. He won the French Derby 4 times, the Arlington Million twice, 2 Irish Derbies, the first Japan Cup, the Hong Kong Cup twice, the Breeders' Cup Mile, over 3,000 victories, 100 of those Grade Ones. It is an honor to introduce to you jockey Cash Asmussen. Cash, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Christina.
I'm out of breath after that very impressive introduction, Cash. And I want to start off the show with a question that I have for you, just out of curiosity's sake. The name Cash, were you born with that name? Where did that come from?
No, my father had called me Cash from an early age, and then It was legally changed at 9 because I was known as Cash, and he's been asked that question on numerous occasions. Why did you name your son Cash? And there was only one response. Even if he's broke, he'll still have cash.
I love it. The name is very fitting, Cash. And let's jump right in then and discuss how you found such great success. You were born in South Dakota, is that correct?
Yes, born in South Dakota, third generation horseman. My father shared everything that he could possibly share in knowledge in life and in horses. And then when I was 16, gave me an opportunity to go to New York with the Bug as an apprentice. And Just gave me an opportunity that he felt that I was prepared for. And I feel that, he had a stable of 120 horses at the time himself, and he had groomed me the best that he possibly could for my debut. And in his unselfish act, he sent me off to see if I could make a splash or conquer a small piece of the racing world.
You said he groomed you for your debut. How did he do that?
I think some of it might be a little too explicit to announce over the radio, but every ounce of horsemanship that he had, we galloped, we rode, and we rode miles and miles. We rode millions of miles together. And just indicators that he had learned from his experiences from picking up the bridle rein to touching one over the eye to galloping these millions of miles with him, and he said, hey, Cash, if you don't pick up his head, he's going to stick it in the ground in about two jumps. What? I think you were one jump too late. And just building it, building a sixth sense, the seventh sense, just building that horsemanship and that instinct. And we might get to that later, but I started out on the ground and started preparing these young horses before I ever had the opportunity to perform with these horses in the greatest races around the world. So that comes secondhand to me. I started on the ground way, way before I started on their back.
And that's the way to do it, Cash. Being surrounded by horses your entire life, was there any question ever that you would someday follow your father's footsteps and be in the business? Or did you have any other aspirations as a young child, maybe, of doing anything else?
No, I think the numerous amount of reprimands and spankings from my mom from whipping on both sides of the couch, I think I had one thing on my mind from an early age. I think I was walking around with a stick and a bridle rein in my hand, and I'd stick the bridle rein on the end of the couch and see if I could ride the couch for a while until my mom thought we might need a new couch. So, no. From the time I could walk, I wanted to follow in my father's footsteps and had the opportunity. And I had the opportunity from a young age to ride a lot of horses, to get on a lot of horses, and just build a communication that hopefully is impossible to explain in words. It needs to be refined to the point to where the only explanation for the communication between the horse and the rider would be the bridle rein, would be how you touch them, how your sweat drops on their body and how their sweat from their body drops on yours. And hopefully when people see a horse and a rider together and they become one, that is the performance, that is the association that all people can respect.
So you learn to listen to the horse from a very young age, and you mentioned learning from the ground up as well. And obviously to help you understand the animal you're working with, it's best to study the animal, as you mentioned, from the ground up. You grew up with your brother Steve. Everyone knows your brother. What was that like? What kind of relationship did you two have?
We were part of the team. I mean, my dad was riding and my mom training, and Steve and I preparing the horses during the week and then watching them perform on the weekends. And, you know, the things that you want to change, the things you want to tweak. I mean, we're 8 and 12 years old, leading them to the paddock and some small race meetings. And what was phenomenal, I mean, that was basically our childhood was our preparation for what we have done or what we're doing now. So, I address any success that we have had in the racing game was partly due, and a main part of it, was from our early education and leading these horses, preparing these horses, and watching them perform under pressure, being there to see if the preparation and the education would suffice for them to be eager to perform, for them to perform in the under pressure in the afternoon the same way they do in the morning. And then if they did, you might continue on the same line. And if they didn't, you'd tweak a few things, and hopefully that the next time that you let them up there to compete, they were more confident and that they were in a position to show their God-given ability.
What type of horse would you say you got along well with the most? Would you take to the nervous fillies or maybe the studdish colts? What would you say?
With no arrogance, because my greatest and the renowned critic for me is the horse. If I pick up the shank, if I pick up the bridle rein, if I go to do something with a horse and I know that he's capable of understanding what I'm trying to do and he doesn't do it, I look at the idiot in the mirror, and it doesn't happen to be the horse, it happens to be me. So with no arrogance, I would say that I got along best with most horses who didn't get along with others.
I like that.
And then when you see something that you are good at, you tend to find yourself in those positions. And then I found that the horses that I was weaker with, that my communication didn't work, it's your greatest challenge, because you make your weaknesses your friend if you don't give up. And once in a while, you'll look around and what you were not great at one time becomes your biggest asset. So in answer to that question, I started off getting along with horses that other people didn't. And then horses that didn't tend to be for example, I would have been known as a rider that was a patient rider. So you're going to find me not on the lead as much. My horses tended to relax for me. I felt relax. If you weren't giving away too much ground and the pace was honest enough, relax means breathing. Breathing means oxygen. Oxygen means good blood flow. And good blood means less tired. So I tended to do that. So then I was with a couple stables that most of their horses wanted to be front runners. And I wouldn't have said that was my particular game plan, but I had to make it my friend, because you need to ride the horses the way they're trained. Some people like to train them for speed. Some people train them to come from off the pace. So riding for this big stable that I was signed up for, and most of them were trained for speed, I had to make it my friend, and my friend became that the horse could be on the lead even though he was as relaxed as if he was in behind horses.
Jockey Cash Asmussen is joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Cash, when did you realize you were ready to start riding?
Oh, well, I thought I was ready to start riding a long time before you're officially 16 and you're allowed to get a jock's license. So I thought, and I was going to be big. You know, I mean, my weight and myself were a partner at all times, because I'm fairly tall for an equine pilot. So I had asked my dad to start riding early and wondered what we could do to get me in a position to ride early. And I mean, I was already riding match races and unofficial races that were, they weren't recognized by a racing association, but everything was the same as far as they raced under weights and they raced under the rules of racing. And my father said that wasn't the plan. You know, the plan is when you're 16, you're gonna get a license and you're gonna win two or three races under my eye, and if I think you're ready, we'll send you someplace that your official apprentice allowance doesn't start until you win five races. So I won three races in the Midwest, and then he sent me on to the East Coast to where I could win my fourth and fifth race, and then hopefully that would lance me into some, that I'd have a little bit of momentum with the 7-pound bug, which you're allowed 7 pounds weight allowance until you ride 35 winners. And then after your 35th winner, you're allowed 5 pounds weight allowance until 1 year after your fifth winner. And that happened to be on the East Coast between Monmouth Park and New York.
So when you headed out east, you were more than ready, definitely. And
I put it this way, I would have had a lot more miles in me than most apprentices who just started riding when they were 16. I mean, I would have, a lot of unrecognized races as far, like I said, they ran under the official rules of racing. They just, you didn't have to have an official license or be an official age.
That's still a very big advantage to have that experience under your belt. So when you arrived to the East Coast, what was the reception? Did you take off pretty quickly?
The reception was not quite as humbling as if winning 1,000 races in 4 years and getting off the plane in France, and they thought I was a gentleman rider going to ride in the non-professional races. It wasn't quite that humbling. But it's nice and humbling whenever you leave the Midwest where your parents were riding and training and successful, and you walk in the racing office and you just take it for granted that you've been known since you were a child of 5 years old at those particular racetracks, and you have, you know, you're respected by the respect that your parents have earned for your family name. Well, when I got off the boat in Monmouth Park, they didn't know if I came from the car dealership or what part of the sticks I came from. So that was humbling enough. That was my reception. We don't know you. What can you do?
But I'm sure you quickly proved to them that you were very capable in the saddle. And as I mentioned in the introduction, 1979, you were the Eclipse Award-winning apprentice. So you obviously took off pretty quickly. And what would you say was the hardest thing for you during that apprentice year? You're new to riding professionally. What was that learning experience like for you?
I think just taking in, I would like to say that my style and that my career followed a path of learning from the best that I could compete with, taking the strengths of some of the greatest riders, professionals, trainers, horsemen that I could have the luxury of coming across, competing with, for, or against, and incorporating that into my game. Not all of it works, but when you see things that work for other people in your profession, I wanted to try it out. I wanted to incorporate it into what I wanted to become as a rider, a communicator, encouragement for my horse, not punishment. And the psych of it is, man or animal against his will is of the same opinion still. You can't force horses to do what they don't want. You can't force people to do what they don't want. But if you can explain to them and encourage them and get on the same page, they'll do things for you and with you that neither one of you knew they could do.
Right.
So it was, I mean, I went to a great place. I went to New York. Great riders. Cordero. George Velazquez. Vasquez. Pinkay. Shoemaker comes in for the fall meet at Belmont. McCarran. So I had the opportunity to compete and learn from some of the greatest riders that had ever picked up a bridle rein. So I didn't have any problem sitting on one. So when you're comfortable in the saddle, you can change, you can adapt, you can try different things. And that's what I did.
For you, Cash, you're, like you mentioned, pretty tall for a rider. I'm also pretty tall, and I'm 5'6". And I know for me, when I started out, I would always look at the taller riders who were accomplished to try to learn how they would tuck themselves up and look good on a horse. Did you find that was maybe tougher for you being taller versus some of the other guys who are shorter and they can tuck up easier?
No, I didn't. I mean, my dad had always worked on my seat. I mean, he because he's taller rider as well. So no, the seat and the looking good didn't pose. It wasn't a problem for me. I mean, I would have ridden 20,000 plus races, and of course, there's times when I would rather have looked better than I did. I mean, I think that you have to keep improving until 6 months after you're passed, after you're off the earth or else you're not trying. But no, I didn't. I needed to become a stronger hand rider. I think that the East Coast and the West Coast tends to lean more towards more of a strong hand rider than the Midwest. And so that would have been one thing that I worked on. I mean, I think the Panamanians, the Puerto Ricans, they'd come from the riding school and they would have been stronger hand riders than some of the Midwestern American riders. And then you take that, and why not incorporate one of the strongest finishers ever who didn't move that much on one, and that would have been Shoemaker. Mm-hmm. But in my mind, the job or the luxury or the performance of the jockey from the time he sees the horse in the paddock until he pulls him up and gets off of him is one thing, to manage his energy. And that's why you would see a guy like Shoemaker, who would win all of these photo finishes and all of these close races, or you wouldn't have said that Shoemaker was the strongest physical finisher. But you might want to remember it's the horse carrying us, not us carrying the horse.
Right.
And the reason he was so strong at the finish and won Kentucky Derby, but we can't even go there. He's won so many races by noses and short heads and what have you. It's the energy that he saved and the energy that he managed throughout the race that allowed his mounts to be so strong at the finish. I mean, you wouldn't have said that Shoemaker was as strong of a hand rider as Cordero, but you wouldn't have want to said that Exceller beat Seattle Slough and Dirty Rotten Nose at Belmont Park either.
Right.
Shoemaker in the saddle from 20 lengths behind, two triple crown winners in the same race, affirmed in Seattle Slough. They put a leader in to go with Seattle Slough. Well, he can't even see anything except the backside. The saddle slips on Affirmed, and he's running off down the backside with Steve Coffin, going head and head with Seattle Slough, a mile and a half at Belmont Park. They go three quarters and nine and change, and Seattle Slough still just gets beat a nose. Mm. But Shoemaker sure looked pretty strong at the finish that day.
Yes.
So I think the moral to the story is take the hands and the relaxation of Shoemaker's mounts, incorporate them with the strength of the finish physically as Cordero, and we might come up with a good pilot.
Definitely did, Cash. You definitely did. And again, you won the Eclipse Award in 1979. What was that feeling like as a young kid at the age of 17? Had to be a pretty satisfying feeling.
It was beautiful. We were at the Waldorf Astoria, and my mom and dad came up, and it was a great evening. I mean, I don't think we sit around resting on our laurels, but, you know, there were days in there when I was riding 14 races a day between Belmont Park and Meadowlands, and would ride seven at Belmont and jump in the car and have a driver and drive through traffic to make it to the Meadowlands, not even take your clothes off, and get home at 1 o'clock in the morning and start over again the next day. So you're going hard, you're fighting your weight, you're trying, you're learning, you're running along, and then you stumble and fall, and then you get up and you go harder. So just to have a minute of recognition of why you're doing it or what you're accomplishing as you are going along is beautiful. I think it puts some air in your sails. I think that you're going hard and you're doing it. And of course, no matter what profession you're in, when you're playing the game hard and you're taking some hard knocks, you're going to ask yourself why you're doing it. You have to. No matter how much you love it, no matter how focused or how passionate you are about what you do, there's going to be days when people have to ask themselves why they do it. And I think when you get a little recognition or you accomplish something that's not ordinary, that reconfirms your focus and your passion. So that was one of those days.
Cash, when did you decide to travel overseas?
I was contacted by Stavros Niarchos and his people what actually happened was Mr. Niarchos had 100 horses or 150 horses with Francois Bouton, and you'll know Francois Bouton, God rest his soul, great man, from a Razi and Miesque in this country. Mm-hmm. Even though he's had many, many other stake winners here, I mean, a Razi would have been one of the most impressive two-year-old winners of the Breeders' Cup, if not one of the most impressive Breeders' Cup winner, period. And he had trained him for Mr. Paulson. And Miesque won a couple of the Breeders' Cup miles as well. But he had 150 horses for Mr. Niarchos. Mr. Niarchos wanted a stable rider. And Francois Bouton was friends with Angel Pena. And Angel Pena, some people might know, who trained for the Phipps family at Belmont, mm-hmm. many champions. And Angel Pena was from South America. He made a little stop in France. And Francois Bouton and Mr. Pena became friends. And when the Niarchos group contacted Bouton and said that they wanted a stable rider and was there an American that might fit, Francois Bouton had contacted Angel Pena, and I was in New York at the time and had just, you know, shortly after I'd won the Eclipse Award, maybe a year later, for leading apprentice, Angel Pena called me and called me into his office, and I hadn't ridden anything for him, let alone ridden a bunch of bad races for him. So he calls me in there, and he commences to curse me and chew on me. Mm. You don't know. This is not the life. This is not the life. The life is in Europe. You need to know Europe before you pass from this earth. I'm telling you, young son, you need to know. So here I am taking a tongue lashing from Angel Pena, who is a great accomplished trainer around the world, training for the Phipps family at Belmont with a big, beautiful barn of well-bred champions. And he's giving me a tongue lashing about don't fall in love with where I'm at. I need to think bigger. So about a year later, I had a meeting with the Niarchos family and Francois Bouton, and flew to France and test drove a few, and they had 150 horse stable and some of the greatest bred horses in the world, and they offered me an opportunity of a lifetime, and the rest.
Well, folks, if you want to hear the rest of Cash Asmussen's story, stay with us. We will be back after this short commercial break. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Pena, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network. But the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
And now, Cash Asmussen guides him off the rail for a clear shot at Lucky Coin, who's continuing to move strongly on the lead. Jerry is picking it up. He's moving through an opening on the inside. Fantastic Fellow tails off. Decorated Heroes in with the shot, but they still have to reel in Lucky Coin, the leader with one furlong to go. Davis still handwriting him in here. Here comes Spinning World. The European storms to the lead in the final furlong. Lucky Coin and Little Teresa's. Jerry closing late, but not enough to get to Spinning World. Spinning World was a world beater today, and Hollywood, he wins by two. And it was close for a second there between Jerry, Decorated Hero, and the early leader, Lucky Coin. The final time here was 1:32.35, equaling the course record and the Breeders' Cup record.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I am joined tonight by jockey Cash Asmussen. Cash, we just heard the replay of your victory in the Breeders' Cup Mile in 97 aboard Spinning World. What do you feel when you hear that replay?
Yeah, the respect for the horse. The respect for the horse. Yeah, and how good did he have to be? I'm about 0-23 in the Breeders' Cup. Definitely not bragging. I'm 0-23 in the Breeders' Cup. The Niarchos family owns him. They bred him. They've been great supporters of mine. Well, I shouldn't say that. Mr. Stavros Niarchos changed the direction of my life, the direction of my family's life. Three daughters born in the American hospital in Paris. They travel the world. They speak three languages. Just between Stavros Niarchos and the horse, the direction of my life, what a luxury, what a direction, what an opportunity, and given by great horses and great people who are associated with them. But no, respect for Spinning World. Spinning World was second in the Breeders' Cup Mile the year before as a three-year-old, stayed in training as a four-year-old, five-time grade one winner, and just improved all of the time. I mean, he was by Nureyev, which was a great stallion that Mr. Niarchos had purchased in Kentucky as a yearling, named him after his friend, the ballet dancer, Russian ballet dancer Nureyev. And so it was special with all of the depth of the family, of the horses that were involved, and what helped create the performance for Spinning World. So it was a great day, great time, but it was about the horse. It was about the horse. He redeemed himself from the previous year, and like I said, how good did he have to be? I was 0-23.
Got the monkey off your back, Cash. So, Ronnie.
Yeah. He was, no, you didn't. I'm not sure that the published weight that they said he was carrying, I'm not sure that if it wasn't more than that.
Well, it got the job done. Definitely.
Exactly. Yeah, had to be good to carry me around there.
So riding as a stable rider for Stavros Niarchos and Francois Boutin, you must have had the opportunity to get to know these horses that were in their care consistently. So that had to feel extra special to already have these relationships with these animals consistently, and then to have such a great victory like that. That had to be even that much more special.
Now you hit it on the head. I meant my appreciation and respect for riding as a team is, I mean, we couldn't explain, right? It couldn't be explained in words, because what it is when you ride as a team, who benefits the most is the horse. Because everyone in the operation is looking after the horse's best interests. And what I mean by that, you know very well, but for anyone who's listening, it's not a one-time ride, a one-time shot. You're signed up for the year, you're signed up for years. And when the horse is not in a position, stumbles leaving the gate, no matter what he does, you're looking after him, and his career and his performances show in the end. And that's the part about being a team that's a little bit different than being independent, where you might ride a horse one time, you won't ride him back. They change riders left and right and what have you. I think the horse tends to pay when there's lack of team effort, because everybody that's involved is more looking after their own interests than the interests as a whole.
I was just going to mention, you see these days, especially in the States, back in the day, an apprentice would have a contract with a particular trainer, or you would see maybe more loyalty as far as trainers and riders and owners sticking together for longer periods of time. But these days, you don't see that really much at all.
Oh, yeah. Now, let's cut the political correctness and just say it just like it is. Hey, there isn't much loyalty.
Yeah.
No loyalty, no faith. Everybody looking after their own interests. I mean, just rough on the horse. It's tough enough to keep these horses in the game. It's tough to keep them in the game because it's a rigorous sport. I mean, all sports are rigorous. There shouldn't be anybody pointing any finger at horse racing. It's football players, basketball players, baseball, any of these sports. When you're competing at this level and you're giving more than 98% of all of us can even understand could be given, no. Of course it's tough on us. Tough on us all. That's why you need to be looked after. That's why coaches need to look after their players, and trainers and jocks need to look after their horses. Yeah.
What?
Little loyalty. Hey, little loyalty helps. It's amazing how a little confidence in a jock helps him perform better.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's out there trying pretty hard. I imagine if their paycheck and their livelihood's on the line, I rarely see people going out there with a nonchalant attitude whenever they might be replaced if somebody dislikes their performance. So, I mean, because I've had, you could take it from me who's ridden 20,000 races. I've had the orders from a lot of people who employed me. So if 7,000 different trainers and 15,000 different owners have put their 2 cents worth in, you have to interpret. You know, and I don't have to tell you. I mean, 70% of the time, it's not going to go the way people imagine.
Yeah.
But no, loyalty, faith, trust, the good things that make things, that allow things to be superior. I mean, you see some people team up in America, and you see good teams.
Mm-hmm.
You see trainers that back riders, and they don't always ride a good race. But you also see the results in the end whenever those people back each other. When one stumbles, the other one picks it up, and vice versa. In the end, the results are better. And I can promise you this, it's the horse that profits.
What's something else you think that we can take away with your experience in riding in Europe? What is something else we can take away from the Europeans here in the States that would improve our great sport?
The stick issue has been such a big issue. I mean, one thing I believe in the whole sport around the world is you have to. I would like to see more people making the rules who have actually used them. Mm-hmm. I don't like people making the rules that are guessing. When I'm riding a big race for you and you've paid me a lot of money to come, and it's very important that your horse gets the best because he deserves who you choose to ride him. When I get to the airport and I've got 10 minutes to get to the jock's room, I take the taxi driver who knows his way. Allow people to make these rules who've already tested them instead of people making rules who are guessing about them. Whether they're drug rules, whip rules, I like to see top-class professionals in a position to apply rules of racing or any sport that have actually lived it, that actually know where the line is of what encouragement and what punishment is. When a horse is going forward and somebody's tapping him on his rear end, he's being encouraged. When a horse is going backward and somebody's whipping him on his rear end, he's being punished. But I think the people who need to enforce those rules need to have been in that position as much as is allowed. People making drug rules need to know what allows horses to perform, what are the wrong kind, what kind of drugs cut their career short because they were allowed to run on drugs that maybe were a painkiller that allowed a young horse to perform at a young age, such as a young athlete, and then they had no career. And I can speak a little bit about that because I'm the one sitting on him. I've sat on him anywhere in the world, from Morocco to Mexico. So from a pilot's point of view, of course less drugs is better. If he's sore, I want him to pull up. I don't want him to break his leg off and stick my head in the ground again. Mm-hmm. So I was in Europe for 20 years, and how many ever times in America, you know, 1,000 winners in America, so I had to go around there a few times. So I'm for the no drug rule. But people have to understand no drug rule. There are some that are therapeutic drugs, and then there's some that are enhancement drugs. But I think that these need to be these rules need to be administered and applied as much as we can by the professionals that have lived it, who are in the game. I mean, that's my take on that part of the deal. I think that's one thing we can take from Europe. It works good over there. The whip rule, as I said, I think it needs to be administered and watched by people who've been there. And good racetracks. I think the maintenance of racetracks is particularly important to the longevity of horses' careers. I think those are a few things that we could take from European racing.
Well, those are a few things we can take, but I tell you what, Cash, they took something from you. They actually copied your riding style. You see a lot of French riders with that same American style that you're really the one who brought over there. You are. And so
I wasn't too popular when I got there, I can tell you that.
But
and the moral to that story is, if you go to a foreign country and you're going to try to implement something new that you believe in, that's tried and proven, and you feel it's great, it sure is nice when you can't read the language.
That would help. Yes, for sure. Make you feel better anyway.
Yeah, well, I read once I could speak and read French, I read them about 5 years later. I wasn't sure I could take them then. But the things that were said in the papers about my American riding style and coming to France and what have you, you have to buy the racing form to see what racetrack you need to go to and what weight you need to do to. But it was good that I could just read what weight I had to do and what racetrack I was going to, not what the comments were on the American riding style that I had implemented in about 1982 in France. We'll just put it that way.
Would you say, so when you arrived, was it pretty difficult adjusting to maybe the culture as well? And obviously they maybe weren't too sure about you at first. What was that? What was it like?
I had great support from my team, which was Francois Bouton and then the Arcos family, which was wonderful. So I was there for 2 or 3 weeks, straight from America, riding 5-6 days a week, and I didn't ride any races for 2 or 3 weeks, asking myself what I had done. And then the first time that I sat on a horse in the paddock, I finally realized what I was doing there. I finally realized why I was here. And of course, that made me feel more comfortable. And then now that, you know, right-handed, left-handed, mile and a quarter races straight with no poles, it took a little getting used to, but I mean, the feel, just going there with an open attitude and not a bad attitude and a team that backed you, I just had to relax a little bit and let it happen. I mean, I will say when I got there in the beginning and you're going right-handed and the ground is falling from underneath you 30 feet every 100 yards, you had to rely a little bit more on your horse because he was so much more comfortable than you were.
That definitely makes sense, yeah.
And you're coming down this hill, you're going right-handed, there's 20 runners, and you're kind of lost, and your horse pricks an ear and looks back at you and said, "Hell, I was scared till I looked up at you." Like, wow. Is it that obvious? He said, "Yeah, if I was lost as you, we'd be in the parking lot." Okay. So I just closed my eyes and held on for a while until I found my way around there. And then the flip side of that is some of the racetracks in France are fairly tactical, and there are a few places that you just can't be and win a race. I mean, if you're on the outside, the turn turning away from you, this, that, and the other. What was wonderful after a time is that you could ride those racetracks in your sleep with your eyes closed, and they weren't exactly easy racetracks to ride. That I had to have been some kind of an asset for my partner whenever they felt unbalanced, and I knew when they jumped 36 feet exactly what kind of ground they were going to hit when they made the next jump. And they went from being a bit timid and a bit lost to a lot bigger and a lot more stronger, a lot more confident, and a lot stronger with every jump. And that's when I felt like I was a good partner.
So, Cash, I want to ask you a question now. When you arrived in France and throughout your career in Europe, people would call you this brash American, and you got this reputation. And I want to know how you got that. What was your attitude like there, and how did that come about?
I think my attitude created it. I mean, I think that I signed a big contract to go over there, and I didn't plan on taking too many prisoners. I mean, I wanted to conquer the racing world. I think I went with that attitude. I think that I allowed the name Cash to precede my arrival. I, you know, 15% wasn't, you know, standard would have been 7-10% charge. 15% wouldn't have, I wouldn't have been shy to charge 15%. And I think that news traveled, that word traveled, and if you have seven rides in a 10-horse, you have seven choices of a ride in a 10-horse race. In seven races, and there's only seven races, I guess you charge what you want to charge, but without being greedy. So it got blown out of proportion, I feel, because in the end, where it came full circle was my passion of the game and my love of the horse outweighed what some would have considered to be greed and only for the money. And it took a while. And proof was in the action. I mean, I might fly to the south of France on my own ticket just to school one in the gates, because I have been having trouble with him the last three times and he's in the gates, and I know all he has to do is behave himself and he's going to win for fun. But that's about the horse, not about could I charge 15% and two private airplane tickets to get there.
Right.
Those kind of things. It took time for those to show through, because they just thought that I was an advantage. That I would charge whatever I could charge to give them the advantage, and that wasn't the truth. My passion and love of the game was why I was there. It's what I live for. I ask a stiff enough fee for what I do, but it wasn't about the fee. You get me, and you get things you can't charge for.
Gosh, time is flying by here. We only have about 5 minutes left, and I want to get to what you're doing now, but I do want to ask this question too. The other riders that you were surrounded with there in Europe, I can't imagine they were too friendly when you're coming to town and you're taking their money and you're just on fire. I can't imagine they were too friendly with you.
No, petitioned to get me out of the country because they felt that I was an outsider, depriving a local of the same opportunity. So, you know, there was some legal problems, everything that you had to, you know, that I had to prove that I wasn't taking someone's place, that I was something unique, meaning nobody. I had won so many races that I was qualified to have a French license, actually. So no, it wasn't, and I mean it made for a little bit of rough competition in the beginning. Actually, it's too long to go into, but they did me a favor because they made me even a more patient rider. When you're in a 10-horse race and you've got eight other jockeys riding your horse with nowhere to go, no place to go, they usually wore themselves out trying to ride my horse. And then, of course, it just made my horse look better because he was so full of energy at the end. He would just run off and win for fun and those kind of things. And it didn't get dangerous. I mean, it got a bit tight on occasion. But, no, it wasn't real friendly in the beginning. And then I think it's a good lesson for all of us in a much bigger picture, in a much bigger world. Why are we all so quick to condemn when we don't understand?
I love it.
So I just used it in the rest of my life. Maybe I will bite my tongue and absorb a few things in my life before I make these judgmental decisions. And wow, is that big for me. I'm just saying. And because of course now it's embraced, and now the French riders that ride around the world ride with the style that I was fortunate enough to take there, and not somebody who was 20 years before me. But it was not embraced in the beginning, and it was not respected, and now it is embraced, and it is respected, and it's used even more importantly, because I think the horse is the one benefiting. I think the aerodynamic style and the rider becoming one with the horse, not a foreign object.
Cash, we
the
just...
horse benefits, and I think that that's what it's all about. So no, it was rough for me, but I tried to. I can say that now. I mean, when I was just about on my knees going into the first turn with 800 horses trying to take my place, I'd like to tell you I was this patient, but I wasn't this patient.
Cash, we only have about 30 seconds left. I really, really quickly want to hear, what are you doing now?
I'm getting these young horses ready and sending them around the world so they can show their God-given talent.
I love it. I love it, Cash, and still going strong. And we have to have you on the show again because there is so much we didn't even have time to cover. And just what a fascinating story you have. And again, I just
no. Really... Anyone listening that loves racing, I just want them to know how much we respect them and how much that we do. They don't know how much that the professionals in this game actually admire them and respect them for recognizing what we do.
Cash, thank you so much for joining us.
I'll speak to you soon.
Folks, you can check out this show and replays of all of our other shows on the website, horseracingradio.net. And be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I am Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.